obsessing about books today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. What books linger in your memory? We'll tell you about ours on Scribble. I don't know about you, Rebecca, but occasionally I run into a book that changes everything, that answers questions that I've carried around for years, and I never forget books like that.
Yep, I know.
Anything like that ever happened to you? Or you read so much, though, that...
Well, yeah, I think when I was thinking about this yesterday, I just started making a fast list of what's still there, because I forget all kinds of, you know, You and I talked once about kind of way back childhood books, so we kind of touched in another show, I think, on mine were Laura Ingalls Wilder, Nancy Drew books, and C.S. Lewis's Narnia, and what were the other? Tolkien, we both talked about Tolkien.
Yeah.
So that was childhood, kind of those are the ones that made me into a reader, I guess, that I really couldn't stop reading when I was engrossed in one of them.
Well, I'm embarrassed because I came to Tolkien when I was an adult.
Oh, that's all right. Lots of people do, you know. That was, how old was he too when he, I think they find us when we need them and we don't even necessarily know that we need them.
Well, I found that by accident. 25 cents for Fellowship of the Ring and
really?
A used book rack to give to Bernadette to read. She would want to read herself to sleep needed help. One page and she was gone. But I gave her this book and she stayed awake.
Oh, my goodness.
I thought, well, that's interesting. And then when it ended, she let out a howl, said, this can't be it. There's more.
And that's when
I found out I'd bought the first book of a trilogy that I could not finish in this country. I had to send away to Blackwell Books to get the rest.
Whoa. Well, so you've got, so she's the one who sent you to read that because of her reaction.
Oh,
to
yeah.
It.
And I thought, okay, I'll read it. And I thought, come on.
Uh-huh.
3 feet high, furry feet. This is the silliest thing I've ever read. And then when I got to Tom Bombadil, I was ready to throw it all away. But I thought, no, stick with it. And I got to the Inn at Bree and I was hooked.
Yeah.
I could not read fast enough.
I know. That's how I remember it, too. I was, we were at our family's cabin in the summer, and, you know, that was the place we were always outside and in the water and in the boats, and I couldn't leave my room where I was reading the book, you know, and I was just, and through the night, you know, with a flashlight, it was just.
Oh, yeah, well, when I finished it, I went back and read it slowly, and then I read it every year for the next 5 years.
It's been a long, I haven't been able to get my kids to read it, although my son, who's 17, just took Fellowship of the Ring with him on his road trip that he's on right now. So we'll see if he actually reads it.
You got to get to the Inn at Bree.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Once you're there, you're done.
Yeah. Well, so that was what I remember us talking about before was kind of earlier on. And so then I was thinking about high school and college and, you know, I was lucky because I had an English teacher for a dad and a poet for a mom, so our bookshelves were full, and I didn't have any sense of what age I should be reading things. So mm-hmm. I was reading Tess of the D'Urbervilles by Thomas Hardy and The Scarlet Letter when I was pretty young, and I was really moved by them, but I realized later when I went back and read them, so I didn't know a lot of what was going on at the time.
Well, you know, when I was growing up, there was a barrier. You could read in the children's section, but not the main library.
Oh, you couldn't even go?
No. Well, you know, those were closed to you. You couldn't check out books.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember that glorious day when I quit the Macklemore Branch Library and went downtown Memphis in this castle right on the edge of the bluff. And I just approached it as if it were a castle.
Sure.
And I had my credit card and my library card in my hand. I thought, I've got the key to it all.
Everything.
I walked in there, and not only did they pass me right through, but
they didn't
card
you.
I was able to go back and go through the stacks. And I didn't know you could do that. And it was like a wonderland.
Yeah, I know.
All these books.
Yeah.
And the glass floor, you know, the dim light, it was a magical place.
Isn't that? Your description reminds me of the first time I went into Powell's City of Books out in Portland, Oregon, which is, it takes up an entire block. And, you know, when you care about poetry, there's usually one little shelf somewhere that has Frost and Shakespeare and, you know, some... And they had a room of poetry with those ladders that you could slide along the wall. And I remember climbing, just starting at the A's and climbing up to the top of the ladder and, you know, kind of looking back at this whole room full of poems. And it was similar to that. And it was like, are you kidding me? It was used and new. And I it's one of those.
Well, you know, going up into New England, they have used bookstores all over the place. At least they did when
I was going to say still.
When we visited there a long time ago. And to me, every time I go to a new town, I look for a bookstore.
Yeah.
And they're getting hard to
find. Harder to find, yeah. I know.
Well, I don't travel much now, so it's not a problem. But, yeah, that was a big thing.
Yeah.
But what book, anything stick in your mind that... really, you know, lodges there permanently?
Yes, lots of them. But probably the one that I remember after college was Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale. And that, I was working at a publishing company, and that obsessed me so much that I was bringing, you know, instead of eating lunch with my cohorts, I was, you know, finding a place to hide so I could read that. Partly it just horrified me. It's...
What was the name again?
The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh yes,
and they've made it now into TV, and you know I haven't watched it.
That is a powerful book.
That book just terrified me into. I remember from sitting in my desk in my office was some scene where the couple, the main characters, are trying to leave town. And the woman realizes the bank won't give her any money. They won't take her card. It's been all shut down. And I remember thinking it would be so easy to do that. It would be so, you know, that already, and this is decades ago.
Well, keep an eye on Texas. They're working on it.
I know. I know. Well, anyway, that one scared me. Like, just, I have loved Atwood's writing for years, but there's something, that one just was a horror story. And
well, it certainly wakes you up to the position of a woman in society.
Yeah, absolutely. And that it was so kind of off the charts, over the top, and yet you read it and think that could happen.
It doesn't take much for it to change.
Yeah.
And the Middle East has not changed since prehistoric times.
Isn't it?
And there's always, I've always said that misogyny is more deeply ingrained than racism.
I think so, too. I think it's one of the, it doesn't matter what culture, doesn't matter what social class, doesn't matter, it's everywhere. It's every single religion, every culture, every government, and I suppose like racism, we feel like we've made some headway, and we have, but...
Well, we've made some headway, but it's still...
I know.
It's still a problem. I want to mention before we go any further... that while we talk about books that obsess us, we'd like to know what books obsess you. And you can let us know by going to the internet at contactscribble.1014@gmail.com. I'll mention that again at the end of the program. contactscribble.1014@gmail.com. We've had some responses, and we're going to get to them in a subsequent program. But right now, we're selfishly talking about our own. One book that answered so many questions for me and gave me a hint of what's going on in the world is The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind by Julian Jaynes. That's a title you can carry with you,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, if I can remember it.
The origin, because I've always wondered about that.
Sure.
What is this self-aware business? Well, an even deeper question is, what is life? There's no hope of getting an answer to that. But self-consciousness. Julian Jaynes is a psychologist. He talks about sitting on somewhere and thinking about this and coming up with this idea. He looked at the Iliad and the Odyssey, and he says there is evidence of the shift from the bicameral mind to the conscious mind. The bicameral mind means that the left brain hasn't yet taken full possession of the right brain. Uh-huh. If it doesn't, you're schizophrenic. But he says most people were that way.
Interesting.
They heard voices. They saw visions. Mm-hmm. The first churches or temples were when a leader died, they cut off his head and put it in the building because they could still hear his voice.
Oh, my goodness.
And evolution was continuing. And when you think about it, when a child is born, it's born with two reflexes, sucking and grasping.
Mm-hmm.
The connections aren't complete to the brain. And as the child grows, those connections become more and more complete.
Mm-hmm.
But in one stage, you may find a child talking to imaginary friends.
Oh, yeah.
What you don't realize is they see that friend and that friend talks to them.
Yeah.
And once you get to what's called the age of reason, the left brain kind of moves over and takes hold of the right brain and takes either total or partial control. And those voices and those visions disappear, maybe appearing in your dreams or when
sure.
you're under great stress.
Yeah.
And he says that that is what's happened to us. And he says in the Iliad, the gods are in there all the time. Thetis appears in the mist. Achilles talks to her and so on. Not in the Odyssey. The Odyssey has this man, and I noticed this in Greek tragedy. They were always worried about Odysseus because apparently whatever you could tell what other people were thinking. They could not betray their own thoughts, but Odysseus could. He could say one thing and do another. And he said that is the beginning of what we call self-awareness, that you can... You know, I can look at you and I can't tell what the heck's on your mind.
Yeah.
But it used to be, yes, I could. But now no one can, and that's distressing. And one of the things he points out is that when the Spaniards came to the New World, they were encountering a group of people that was still largely bicameral. The Aztecs couldn't understand why it was that this creature came in, this horse, and suddenly it gave birth to a man. They saw the man sitting on that, figuring this animal was giving birth to this creature.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
did not understand what they were facing. And it was that uncertainty that made them think maybe these are gods.
Gods, uh-huh.
And that led on... All the way down the line, he answered one question after another of that type.
When did you read it?
Oh, Lord, I don't know. When it first came out, I couldn't let it go.
Yeah.
And at the time it came out, everybody was talking about it.
Okay.
And now, of course, it's just faded into the background. But what I learned from that gave me an answer as to why people have changed through the years. Not only has the human mind evolved, but society has evolved as well.
Yeah.
And we are not aware of evolution because in us it goes so slowly. On the other hand, in the coronavirus, it goes like a machine gun.
Yeah.
But that book is still, I think, relevant. The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. The author is Julian Jaynes, Jaynes. And if you can't remember the title, maybe you can remember his name.
Yeah.
It's worth reading.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. What else is in your memory?
All right. Another one that comes to mind always is Virginia Woolf. And the first time that I read A Room of One's Own, which was part of this lecture series that she gave, but then to The Lighthouse, which were just also kind of blew my mind open about what you could do on the page, what you could do with writing, a kind of stream of consciousness, but not really. You know, it was just I've wanted to go back and reread To the Lighthouse, because that was one too where at the very end I just kind of sat stunned by the whole thing. You know, it's
isn't it interesting when you read a book that does that to you?
Yeah, that you just can't move almost, because it's, you know. And I've also, when you posed doing this, I thought of the books that I've reacted to so strongly, that Tessa the D'Urbervilles, Hardy's. I remember throwing that book across the room, just thinking, "This is horrible." Same thing with Scarlet Letter.
You know, I've done that.
they were, you know, gender issues, but they were also about injustice. And you know, I couldn't. I loved the writing, and I was really engrossed in the stories, and I just couldn't bear it. You know, I'd throw it against the wall, and then I'd storm out of the room, and then I'd come back and get it again because I had to keep reading. And
when I finished Gone Girl, I felt violated.
Oh, really?
I thought, I guess, why did I touch this poisonous book?
Yeah.
And yet it was absolutely fascinating.
I haven't read it.
But I
that.
Just, I thought, no, this is all wrong.
Yeah.
But you didn't get that reaction. On the other hand, I talked about Mexico. I was fascinated with William H. Prescott when I heard that he had sight problems, and he stayed in Boston, and he wrote The History of the Conquest of Mexico.
Oh.
And he did this with the aid of other people, but he also took a different approach. He only dealt with original documents, and he got people in Mexico to ship him the stuff. And he wrote this magisterial book, and it remained the basic book on the history of Mexico for decades. And that was way back in the 19th century.
Oh.
And it's a sweeping story, and I must say there are moments in it that just take your breath away.
Mm-hmm.
When what's his name? Shoot, the conquest of Mexico. Cortez, when they finally fought their way out of the city, when the Aztecs were determined to get them, and they were working their way to the sea, and they suddenly came out into this valley, and it was filled with Aztec warriors.
Mm.
I mean, there was no escape. And Cortez, I don't understand this guy, but he said, okay, you know, let's go. And he saw off in the distance a setup where the ruler was. And he drove his horse right through the group, right to strike down the man there, and the crowd dissolved.
How's that possible?
I don't know.
Oh, my.
But it was just an amazing thing to read that, because I always thought, how could the Aztecs have given up?
Mm-hmm.
But Julian Jaynes will give you a reason, and William Prescott will describe how it happened. There have been other histories that will really correct some things in that, but I will never forget reading Prescott's History of the Conquest of Mexico.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope everybody's writing these down, because they're got to get back to... It is always hard, isn't it, to decide whether you continue reading new work that you've heard about or that you've wanted to get to, or you go back and reread something that you loved and is far enough now in the past that you sort of think, I'd like to.
Do you do much rereading?
I guess I haven't now in years. I mean, teaching kind of keeps you having to read what you have to teach and what's kind of right in front of you. And I haven't, I guess when I was reading to my kids, I went back, you know, when my kids were little and we'd have stories. I reread all the Little House on the Prairie books and all of those. But things like The Scarlet Letter, Tessa the D'Urbervilles. I guess I reread The Awakening because I had to teach it years ago when I was teaching it.
Who wrote that?
Sorry, now I'm having...
Yeah, we're both we're both kind of strangling today. I shouldn't ask a dirty question like that.
No, I'm just... I've got this whole list and all these books in my mind. But that one... which one did I just mention?
The Awakening.
Oh, The Awakening. That's Kate Chopin. And that one was... It was an awakening experience to read it. It was set in the South. It was the story of a woman kind of abandoning her very privileged life because of her desire to be an artist and how unacceptable that was. And
I think it must be interesting to read stories about a woman's place in society when that's such a hot topic still.
That was what hit me when I looked at my list. They're almost all women on my list. And I thought, I think from a really young age, it just resonated differently. And we weren't being taught in the 70s and 80s in school. We weren't reading women's writing. So I kind of found it elsewhere. But when I look back from this point, I think I really needed them. I needed them to... kind of back up my experience in the world, my experience as a reader. It's not that I haven't loved male writers too, but my list is almost Emily Dickinson, Alice Walker's Color Purple. You know, just...
I remember when we had our 50-year class reunion of a class I taught at Alleman, Humanities, where I just had kids read and talk about books. And they had all gone on to just fabulous careers. But I mentioned to them, I said, why is it that almost all the women here are in medicine? And he said, well, Don, think about it. 50 years ago, what was open to women, secretarial work or mm-hmm. nursing?
Yeah.
That's right. The world has changed.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to my childhood, the great upheaval in society in the Second World War was when women went to work in
sure.
factories.
Yeah.
That had not been done before.
Yep.
So once you let that genie out of the bottle, it was not going to change, although they tried.
They tried, yeah.
They certainly tried
to send
and
back,
succeeded to an extent.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, it's been interesting to watch with my kids, too, because my daughter has always been just drawn to stories about women, show movies about women. You know, she kind of isn't interested if it's just about men. And I think I've had my own version of that earlier, but there were fewer women teaching. Yeah, you went to male doctor even if you were a girl, and thank goodness a lot of that has
well,
shifted.
I've always figured women should run things because women, as a biologist, women are at the center of life.
Yep.
Life flows through women, not men.
Yep.
Men have a role in it, but it isn't as central as that of a man. And that's why I think men shouldn't bother trying to tell women how to live or anything else.
Yeah.
But you do have to come to some kind of neutral position but in the war of the sexes.
It's endlessly complicated, isn't it?
I told you that Bill Hebert's idea of marriage is a... like a treaty between nations. I thought, that's not bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But let me get to an author that impressed me greatly. I love mystery stories. I love Peter Robinson's stories about DCI Alan Banks and his adventures in East Vale, which is supposed to be a village in Yorkshire. He's written over 24 books on this, and they're all good, and they move in progression. You got to start with the first one mm-hmm. if you want to enjoy it. But the guy at the top is Ross MacDonald. His real name is Kenneth Millar, and his wife, Margaret Millar, was also a writer of mysteries. But he took the name of Lou Archer. He took it from Sam Spade's buddy, Miles Archer, and also Lou Wallace, who wrote Ben-Hur. and he got Lou Archer. And those books by Ross MacDonald sit atop that tradition started with Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, the hard-boiled California detective, and took it to a whole new level. Psychological insight, strong use of imagery. He was a PhD, and Joyce Carol Oates was his tutor when he was working on his master's. So the guy really had a good grasp of the language and how to use it. He told a fine story, but the depth of those stories was surprising in detective literature. Anytime you have a chance to read Ross MacDonald, there are other MacDonalds, but Ross MacDonald is the one that really, I think, sets the bar so high in the genre.
And when did you encounter that?
Oh, Lord, you're asking me about time.
I shouldn't do that.
I can't put dates on anything.
I know.
I say it's like chocolate that's melted.
It's just all flowing in the past.
Yeah, it is.
I know. I hear you.
It's in the past, put it that way.
Well, I keep taking notes because I want to read the things you're describing.
No, you don't have to read those. We have a couple of minutes. Is there anything else you want to mention? Quickly.
I was thinking how also once I went off to grad school to study poets, my attention turned far more to poetry than it did to prose that I had been reading up to that point. And they're too probably the women poets, Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath, Elizabeth Bishop.
Sexton and Bishop, huh?
Yeah, and Mary Oliver came later, kind of the natural world, prayerful. But there were also like Louise Glück and Linda Gregg and Carolyn Forché, who I've talked about plenty of times.
Well, anyway, we've rambled on here about books that we have loved and that have impressed us and maybe even changed things in our lives. And we hope that you look at books that way because they can really have a profound impact on you. Well, what you read impresses you more deeply than what you see on TV.
Yeah.
It really does. As a guy who spent years doing TV documentaries, I'm here to attest to that. But we'd love to know what you like to read and books that you have enjoyed. And you can let us know by contacting us at, this sounds right, contactscribble.1014@gmail.com. That's the anniversary of when we began this program, which we are celebrating right now. October the 14th was our date of our very first program. So contact us at contactscribble.1014@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your ideas on the books you enjoy and the ones you'd like to share with others. And with that, we'll summon the theme and head out. Thanks, Rebecca, for digging into the past with me.
Yep.
And thank you for joining us. We hope you'll do the same next week when we come back with another Scribble.